Okay, Hannah, are there any additional things you want to talk about before we leave Beaver around 1950?
Well, I will say that Beaver was a nice place because I think my father promoted some things that were not seen anyplace else, because the Alaska Steam used to have a little booklet. I have one someplace, and it says, and it says Beaver, after it names all the other places, you know, and Beaver, it says, the cleanest town in Alaska. Oh, the cleanest town on the Yukon, or something like that. We never had garbage on the beaches, you know.
Huh.
No. And then he was always buying flowers for anybody to plant flowers. He just loved flowers, you know. So maybe it's because of my name.
I know. That's right.
That's right. Who knows? Yeah.
Did you know that your name was Flower?
No, I didn't know that. When I went stateside, I think I told you, didn't I tell you about my first grade teacher changed my name from Hannah to Hannah because mm-hmm. this was wrong. Mm-hmm. So I was Hannah all the years I was out there.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I came to Fairbanks, I was Hannah too. So I'm Hannah all over except here.
Mm-hmm.
Even though my name is H-A-N-A, everybody called me Hannah, Don Valdez or Bethel or Gacona, Glen Allen, you know, but here I had a namesake. Miss Arlen Hansen was a teacher in Glen Allen, and they were expecting, and so they had a little girl. He said I'm going to name her Hannah Marie. So, so when we moved to Palmer, he said, your name is Hannah. It's not Hannah, it's Hannah. And I said, okay, so everybody calls me Hannah here. Mm-hmm. Makes it nice. Finally get my own name back.
Did your sisters get Japanese names? You were the
no,
only one.
I'm the only one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wonder, too, if you have any feelings about the way that there's been a lot of recognition of your father's work with Beaver.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have any feelings about the way he's being or has been portrayed? Certainly the Japanese media have picked up on him, and films and things have been made about his life.
No, I think it's really nice that he's been recognized, but because he was such a quiet person and never said anything about anything, you know, he never was an I person. And now that I'm taking Japanese, I know that you're not an I, you know, you're always very humble when you're talking the Japanese, I mean, what do they call it, the right type of speaking. The other family or other people are always honored, but you're humble, you know.
Yes.
And so I think he lived that life a lot. He was always such a kind person to everybody, even the drunks. You know, we had one man that drank and his partner hit that man over the head and took him home and laid him on the bed so he wouldn't be a pest. And my dad could hardly stand that, you know. But I just heard that that was a terrible thing to do. That was all I needed to know, that he didn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose the other men, they had business to do and he couldn't be bothered. You know, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Just out of curiosity, when Oshima and your dad were together, do you remember whether they conversed in English or in Japanese?
They were really never together.
Never together.
Never together. He lived away from Beaver,
uh-huh.
about a mile or 2 miles downriver. And I think he felt better, and I think maybe he left home because he stuttered very badly.
Oh.
Huh. It was difficult to listen to him, you know, to talk with him. I talked with him, but you just have to be real patient, you know.
Uh-huh.
But he stuttered very, very badly. But he was a very intelligent man.
Mm-hmm.
What was your father's recollection after the war? Did he comment much about his experience of being evacuated?
Well, I remember he said that on the trains that all the windows were always blocked out, you know. They didn't know where they were many times. But when they would be at a camp and he would meet different people, he was really very happy in a sense to meet with some of his countrymen, you know, that he hadn't seen for so many years. But he couldn't speak the language, but he could understand it. He said his tongue wouldn't do it, you know, wouldn't do it. But then toward the end of his stay, he was able to say some words and be able to speak it, you know, by that time, he was heading back home because there were many letters that came to this Brigadier General. What's his name? Simon Bolivar?
Buckner.
And to these people that he worked, he bought from or he worked with, like the Marshal's office and the highway department, the head of the highway department from Juneau, and Bishop Bentley, and the hardware company, I forgot his name, in Seattle, the Seattle Hardware Company, and then the Schwabacher brothers who sold canned things most of the time, and the Black Bear Manufacturing Company. They wrote and said that Frank Yasuda was a better American than any of you, or whatever, you know, however he said it. That he helped the people, and he was always a helping type of a person, mm-hmm. you know. And I think that's why Beaver was really quite a peaceful place for so long, really. Mm-hmm. Because I think, and then of course he had the citation from the legislature. I think you have seen it.
I've not seen it.
You've not seen it. It's a nice thing that was presented to us when John Binkley was down there.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A lot of nice things in it, you know.
Well, certainly he was exceptional in having provided stability for the community.
I think so. Mm-hmm. He never liked to see somebody hungry, so it was like, he'll never get rich. And here I was going to college and I could use all the money that he could make. But you know, when you're at that age, you really don't know many things. And I used to think that I could run the business better than he could. And I think I've told you also that the Swede boys, Victor and Olaf, especially Victor, said, "Oh, Frank's going to be eating his books one day, you know, that's all he has." Everything is in the books, yeah.
Yeah, you did mention earlier that your father certainly carried a lot of people on the books.
Mm-hmm.
But never wanted to see any of them go without things that he felt they needed.
Well, after thinking about this too, I think of people from the town lower, you know, next town below Beaver, and then the town above Beaver.
Mm-hmm.
We had people coming from there to come and get their things because they had no more credit, which, you know, I would be one to say this is not the way it should be, but he gave them credit, and they promised to pay. You know, they would say that they would pay, but the funny thing was that they would pay up to so much so that he'd have to carry them the next year. So those people really knew what they were doing, you know. Dad knew too, but he would never dwell on it.
Mm-hmm.
like I did. But then, as you grow older, I think you become more mellow when you think, you know, that's a great way to be. Yeah, he had a good life.
Now, did your father continue then running the store until he died?
No. His legs were bothering him, and he helped people still, but he didn't run that store much.
Did he?
My husband and I ran it.
I see. Mm-hmm. And how long did the store continue then under your...
Oh, just about 5 years, I think, because we went bankrupt.
Oh.
You know. I didn't...
You were inheriting a heck of a lot of books there, it sounds
like.
I don't know.
I don't... I'm not a very good businesswoman, you know. I mean, things like that, so I have never really stopped to try to figure that one out.
Mm-hmm. So the store closed in approximately 49?
I think it closed closer to 47.
47, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And then when did your father die?
How can I not know this? I think maybe 57.
Mm-hmm. He remained, though, in Beaver.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how about your mother? Was she in good health?
Yes, she was. She stayed with us after my father died. We brought her with us in the winter months, and she'd want to go back in the summer. Then we'd get her back to be with us, and then finally she stayed with my sister. My sister was her... I've always sort of felt that she was closer to my sister than to me, and I was close to my father.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And so she would stay with Bernice and Kodiak.
Mm-hmm.
But she didn't like staying over there. She liked to visit, but she liked to stay with us.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of, I don't know whether it's humorous or what, but Bernice had a shower. That's all they had. She and her husband had a shower. And my mother didn't like the shower. You know, she liked a tub.
Uh-huh.
And so I can't do anything but smile that she wanted to be with us because of the tub. But who knows? She just loved to get in the tub.
Uh-huh.
So, who knows? I, you know, she never told me, except that she did say at one time she didn't like showers. We had a shower and a tub, but she didn't want to take a shower.
Did you guys have a big bath in Beaver? A furo?
No. Furo?
Japanese style tub?
I thought it was Furuba. Furuba,
yes.
Furuba. Oh, I see. Well, I don't know if you were in Alaska long enough to hear about the Samson Hardware on the China.
Right.
My dad had a tub that they made, you know, I don't know, some metal tub.
Uh-huh.
And it took so much water, though, lots of water, you know, because you could sit like this. But then my mother liked a tub that was a lot smaller. But my father had somebody named, it was Dan George's father. They've been dead a long time, but the father was a carpenter, and he made screens for the house. Those are like Japanese screens.
Yeah.
So we had screens for the house, except instead of having the flower thing, they used cretonne, a material that's used for curtains, you know, for that part. So they folded, and you put them out of the way, and then when nighttime came, they came out, and they were just used for made rooms. Mm-hmm. Isn't that mm-hmm. neat?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they had tubs that they used and got into and washed, mm-hmm. took a bath.
It's interesting to see what people take along with them as part of their daily living style, mm-hmm. food and other cultural amenities, I guess.
Well, when I was in Antioch for a while, they had sweat baths there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Steam.
Yeah.
Steam bath.
Mm-hmm. And in Nome, they had some there too. I don't know any place else where they had any or not, but.
I think the assumption is that that was a derivative of Siberian traditional native peoples.
Oh,
I
don't
know. That whole pattern has come into Alaska. It's common along the coastal communities.
Oh, I didn't know this. I saw this one in fairly close to the school in Nome. And I didn't know anything about it because in Washington, we didn't have very many Finnish people there. They're the ones that were great saunas, yes. And Ray's family, you know, in Minnesota, they had a room about this big. It was just, was a nice place to be in, except I would have to have it myself because I can't stand that hot. It's too hot. And, it's really like one of the main buildings, main room, you know. They had different steps.
Mm-hmm.
Hotter and cooler, I guess, you know.
Right.
Yeah. And throwing this water on the rocks is something mm-hmm. else.
That's right. Well, getting back to our chronicle here with you going to teach. In 51, you went to Nome.
Mm-hmm.
Did you go there for a long period? What were you doing?
Well, the year that Dr. Ryan had asked me to teach under him, and I just waited and wondered, finally decided not to because I heard about the conditions and I was afraid to face that. So I got a telegram from Nome. He was the president of the school board there, Bob Baldwin. He lives in Fairbanks now. And he asked me to come and teach because this one teacher in Fort Yukon, what's his name, Mr. Richards, was teaching in Teller.
Mm.
One summer he came through Fairbanks and saw me working at the post office, and he asked me, he said, I thought you wanted to be a teacher, and I said, I do. I'll get there one day. So when he went back to Teller, evidently he told Bob Baldwin that he knew somebody that would like to teach. And that's how come I went to the Nome schools to teach.
Mm-hmm. And how long were you there?
We were there 2 years.
And what did you teach?
I taught second grade and coached basketball, all the PE classes.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Was that a good experience?
Oh, yes, but, you know, like, we'll say 3, 4, 5 years later, I thought, boy, that was not the way to teach. You know, you keep learning how children would learn better,
mm-hmm.
and you keep changing until you think you think you've got it. There's always something else coming up to say, well, this is going to be better. So I think many teachers in those years tried to get better and better, you know, something that will help the children more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So in Nome then, were you married to Ray?
Mm-hmm. Ray and I got married in Nome. I met him on the basketball court.
Oh my goodness.
He was one that we would shoot baskets. We played 21 or horse, and I was forever beating this coach. I mean, he was the other coach. They had three coaches there, different groups, you know, like Pete Hahn was the varsity coach, and then Ray had a group of young ones that were called the Kangaroos because his name was Kangas, And Williams, who is now in Portland, had another group, and so three of us would go in the gym and we'd shoot baskets for maybe 25 cents.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you're going to have to throw that out. And Herb Williams owes me money yet, but...
you got to collect. The interest should be worth something.
It should be. That's a long time ago. And Ray would just let me win. Then toward the very end, he couldn't stand it, so he'd make all the baskets and just pass me up. I'd be so upset. That's how we met. He was really good. Set shooting was very easy. Well, that was easy for all of us, I think, but Herb wasn't that good, so I was...
Don't always cream him on those.
Yeah.
Well, what happened after Nome?
After Nome, we decided... Ray has always wanted to be in Alaska. That was his first teaching position. He had been teaching in Michigan. So I knew he wanted to see Alaska, and of course I hadn't seen too much of Alaska either, so we decided to, you know, say 2 or 3 years in one place and go and see another place. You know, that's how come. From Nome, we went down to Heidelberg because somebody had asked us to come down there. So, oh, Mr. Richards went down to be the superintendent down there, and he said, I want you to come down with us. So we went down. So we were there 2 years, and then after Heidelberg, we went to Valdez, and we taught there for 2 years. And after that, we went to Bethel, and we taught there 3 years, I think, 3 or 4. Maybe 3 years, they wanted us to come back, but I think we didn't, or whatever. Went back to Valdez because somebody said, why don't you come back? So we went back to Valdez and taught there, and of course, after that, you know what happened, 64, the earthquake, so we had to leave. Then we went up to Glen Ellyn, I taught Copper Center, Ray taught in Glen Ellyn, we had a commissioner that was very supportive of the teachers and said those that were teachers in Valdez or any place in Alaska that had to move out would get other positions. So Ray taught at Glen Ellyn, and I taught at Copper Center.
Who was the commissioner then?
I think it was Zaradnicek.
Zaradnicek,
And he's from this area.
And
then after that, we had a man from... ASOS in Anchorage that said, we've got a place, just a place for you to teach. Because we wanted to see it more of Alaska, and he was going to send us out to one of the islands, like St. Paul, I think.
Oh.
And we were really looking forward to it, but I thought, oh, that long plane ride with all that water, and I didn't want to go, but I wanted to go. Was there a magic way to get over there besides flying? But then... it sort of petered out, and then we were going to go someplace else. And finally he said, there's a good place that you would like. And he said, Iliamna is a beautiful place to go. Big lake, you know, there's a big lake, lots of fish. And he said, you'll have morning class and afternoon class. One of you will teach in the morning. You'll have all afternoon free. And the other one would teach in the afternoon. The one in the morning, I'd be all free. It sounded so good. But as it turned out, those children were, like, way behind. And so I taught. Ray did the cooking for the class in the morning. And when we would eat, and then another group would come in the afternoon, that would be the little ones. No, the big ones, because... the big ones didn't want to get up early in the morning. Oh. They came at 7:30 in the morning.
Oh my goodness.
So the bus would bring them. Oh, I forgot to tell you that. The school was between Iliamna and New Haven. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing in between. Just miles, you know. I think 6 miles from one for the other, something like that. So, Ray, I taught in the morning while Ray cooked. And then in the afternoon, we had to feed the young ones as they first come in. No, no, the big ones is when they first come in. And then I would have to teach his fourth grade.
Mm.
So I had the first 3 grades in the morning and then fourth grade, because he had quite a large group.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have all that free time that we were going to have.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How many students did you have then in that?
I can't remember. I think I had about 15, and Ray must have had about 20-some.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So you had your hands full there.
Yeah. And we had graduation 1 year, one student graduated.
Were you that tough on them, so you didn't let them through?
Well, that's Ray's. He was teaching the upper grade. But we enjoyed every place we've been. It was really a wonderful time to teach. I think we had the most wonderful years in every place we went. After Ileana, then we came back to Glen Allen. And there we stayed forever because it was such a good place. We had small schools there. See, Glen Allen's the main school. Then they had these other small schools.
Right.
And I really believe that the small schools are the way to go, not having 20, 30, 35 children in the classroom, because there was a great difference in Glen Allen, because it just seemed that one day we were talking about it, I said, gee, Ray, you know, after school, it's really great when you prepare for the next day to say that, boy, this was a good day we had. Whereas the teachers are really quite controlled, not only with the larger schools, I mean, you know, and so many children, you don't have that good feeling of saying, we did this and then some. Mm-hmm. And we had time for little plays or time for games or something else, you know, it was a good day. So that if they would just cut down on the number of students, I think the teachers would have an easier time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's when I visit the schools now, some of the schools, school classes, the teachers have a big load, you know.
Mm-hmm. What year did you folks retire then?
I don't know. We've been retired about 11 years now, I think.
So about 1980?
Oh, no, we retired before that. It was 79.
79.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
What? How would you characterize the differences in the schools that you've taught in?
How do you mean?
Were the kids different culturally? Did you see much similarity or more difference as you went around
the
various schools?
Well, when we left Nome to go to Heidelberg, it was like, what happened here? Because the students, the older ones, seemed to want to run the place. Now, this was early, in the early years. And I don't know what happened there, but they would say, well, we always had an hour recess. But I think, you know, they're pulling your leg, you know, saying, we have an hour recess. We had our recess last year. Well, 2 hours plus that noon hour, we hardly had any school then. But then we never, you know, believed them. We sort of believed them, but we said we're not going to go that way. We found that they were really slow. I mean, they should have been maybe 2 grades or 1 grade ahead, but still they were like this. So. But they had just changed over to a territorial school. Uh-huh. It used to be a BIA.
I see.
They had a beautiful building there. Not beautiful, very sturdy building. In those years, all the dirty buildings were built by the BIA.
Uh-huh.
Those are government schools. And boy, if there's some of the schools that we have now, and we've taught in a couple new schools the way they make them these last years, and I don't know, they're just not built like they used to be built. Copper Center School was a BIA school, and they had full basement, everything was concrete, everything, it was just good the way they did it, you know, because they had drains here and drains there. You never had, if it flooded, you know, it would be taken care of. And it was just a good, solid building.
Mm-hmm.
But nowadays, the new buildings many times are just, they look good, but I don't think they're that.
There's no quality in them.
No.
Mm-hmm. What about the other locations that you taught? Did you find distinctiveness in those communities and in the kids?
Well, in Nome, the first place I went to, I remember Ms. Newland wanted me to take the slow group, and I didn't really understand her being a new, you know, I'd never taught before. In fact, I had never had teacher training like they would send students to Fairbanks to teach.
Mm-hmm.
We never had that because we had only buses to go in, and my classes were in such a way that I just couldn't go in there to do it. So that's how come I did first aid and did part of that PE, mm-hmm. PE group. But these were with older college students, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a lot different.
That's right, than younger kids.
But in Nome, I found a lot of the Eskimo, the very young Eskimo, first, second graders, they could only speak Eskimo, you know. So that was a great difference. But when we went to Heidelberg, everybody spoke English.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. In fact, it was really very comical. My daughter, Shelley, said, oh, we're going down, we're going to get to see them wear blankets, you know. And she's seen pictures of feathers,
sure.
And everything, so we went down there. And I think we saw one family with black hair, as black as mine used to be, you know. And so many of them were blondes and redheads.
Redheads.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, beautiful, coppery red.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful, yeah. So that was a big disappointment to Shelley.
I guess so.
To me too. I didn't know what I was going to see, but I was really surprised.
Hmm.
And I said to this one girl, she's very, you hear sometimes talking about Native culture. Her name used to be Morrison. There were three Morrisons down there. These men, the two Morrisons we knew, were real Haidas, and they went to school at University of Washington, and they met their wife there, you know. So these girls are blondes. Most of them were blondes, one family. And I said to this girl, Diane, I said, you don't even look like a Haida. But she said, I'm a Haida. And I said, how much? You know, but it was the third generation then, because, it was the first. She was half. But then she said, she was talking about her other cousins or what. They had, I think, 1/16, but they will not say that they're anything else but Haidas.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, maybe, you know, they were taught this,
mm-hmm.
so that one day, there will be a day when they will maybe get their allotments or whatever. I don't know, you know, I was just thinking maybe that could be, but who knows, you know, parents getting their children ready
mm-hmm.
for things like this. And around there, like the Paratovich, were very busy trying to get things settled for that, for
land
their
claims.
Tribes and everything too, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Since we're dealing a bit now with the culture of the various kids that you're working with, I wonder if you have any personal feelings about how important culture is in your own background, in the way you live your life, and the way kids should live their lives.
I don't quite understand that, but I was going to say that it really isn't until I think you get a little older and understand that there are these different cultures, because when I came back from Washington, I said, this is not the right way to do this. You have to do it this way. And sometimes I think that we do that without thinking. It's not good to do that, but we don't mean, maybe sometimes people mean to be that way, but we don't really understand that there are cultures and there are cultures and there are cultures, and they're all different in a certain amount, you know. There's so many differences, like even this day and age, I don't think we understand the people in Saudi Arabia in that area. You know, we need to know before we do, I think. But maybe you got to take that off too. But you know, we don't understand them. I don't see how we can understand them, because we have one man here that worked in Saudi Arabia that used to say, "Well, we ought to have their government because we won't have any crime around here. They'll just chop your head up." You know. And you know, it's really, really different. And they don't understand us. This is a big problem. And of course, when my father first came to Alaska, he said, "I don't understand why the Eskimos do this. He never said Eskimos, but I knew who they were. He was talking about. He would say, "I don't understand them, you know." But they said they're pretty good about some things, you know. But he was not one to overload them with his culture.
Uh-huh.
And I think we have to be more aware of people's cultures. But then how do you go about teaching this, like we'll say for the little ones? Little ones are easier to teach, but as they get into their teens, you know, when we get in our teens, we just know everything, it seems like. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards you start thinking, but we hardly know anything. And then to learn the Japanese culture, I've been over in Japan, let's see, 3 times now or 4. And it's really something, but it's changing too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Really interesting. Those things are very interesting. But I know that the Eskimos in Beaver just stuck to their culture.
How did that manifest itself?
It was good. How do you mean? It was
through
good.
Language and through everything they did.
Well, they always spoke their language, and they always made their parkies a certain way, the good way, which my mother was such a good sewer that she would get these orders, but she would never have the sleeves long enough, and they want their sleeves down to their wrist, and she would not do that. She said they don't need them there because they have mittens to go over. And when they have the mittens off, why they have the mittens off, she'd say, they have to work. So all that fur will be away from their work, you see. Mm-hmm. So she would never change.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way you could say. I said, "Well, Jim Dodson wants his parky sleeves down here." "I don't care," she said. "I'm..." He was a pilot, you know. They just hang on to what they... I think they feel secure, like we feel secure with what we do. But with me and a lot of people now, we tend to take everybody's little culture. You know, something works better, we do, and some better, so that we lose, and we just have all these cultures with us. Like I like Thai food, I like Japanese food, so we have it sometimes. You know, we like Mexican food. I'm the only one here that likes Eskimo food, except I don't like the coastal Eskimo food that much because we're not used to it. But, you know, everybody that lives far apart, if there's a mountain between them, there's a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Are you on the other side of the mountain here from us, aren't you?
No.
Okay, we're down to the final section on our tape here. Do you consider Alaska a good place to live?
I do now.
Why?
Well, there's so much beauty up here, you know. I haven't been very many places, though, you know, in the stateside, you know, if I were to go out there. But I do like Palmer, but it doesn't like me so much because my doctor says, well, how come you settled here when there's dust in the air all the time? I said, we have sunny days. He said, it doesn't matter. When sunny days, you're going to have dust in Palmer. Because he said, there's a lot of dust in Palmer, and I have asthma, you know. But Anchorage, too, has a lot of dust.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You're going to have to live on a ship someplace, forever going between ports.
You know what's really good was Heidelberg.
Oh.
Rain, washed all the dust. Yeah. Sometimes we'd see, I'd look out and see, it was like strings hanging, you know, coming down. To have rained so much.
Mm-hmm.
But see, we're on a high ground, everything runs down, everything's cleaned, you know.
That's right.
Mm, yeah, it was really nice in Heidelberg, but it just seemed my father and mother were getting up in years, and I just had to be on the highway where we can get, you know, get to see them.
Sure.
My husband didn't want to come, though. He really liked Heidelberg.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any anxiety about the future of American-Japanese relations?
I don't think I see too many of them, so that I never think about this. Except, you know, like now, when we hear on TV about what they think about Japan, they're not doing this and not doing that. I just wonder what it is, because they are, I think, monetarily they're doing a lot, but I thought at one time they were not to get their war machines up again, and you know.
Sure, we're pushing them over that edge, huh?
Yeah.
Well, our tape is just about at the end, so I'm going to ask the final question of any last comments that you would like to have included on the tape.
As I said before, you're going to have to ask a question. I don't know what to say, except we've just had a real good life in Alaska. And it's a good thing I didn't win out when I said, Ray, let's go back and live in Minnesota.
Mm.
And he said, well, let's live here for a while longer. But as it went on, we just lived here forever. You know, I mean, we're still here. And I have some friends in Fairbanks, and it's nice, and some in Anchorage, and I can, you know, fly home and mm-hmm. visit with them once in a while, but there's hardly anybody I know that's left. In fact, when I went back there to talk to the children some years ago, they didn't know who Frank Yasuda was.
Oh.
It's just like, I didn't even know that Israel had all the